Good morning. I appreciate the fact that many of you have chosen on a very beautiful day to come here and to spend your day learning from the Scriptures, learning things that are practical to us and our own families, but also as we seek to help others. It's kind of funny, the topic this year, we've had a few people say, well, I really want to hear those, but I'm embarrassed to come to the meeting, so I'll get the audios afterwards. So just because you're here doesn't mean anybody thinks that you have any big problem here. I think as we're going to see in the first session, we all struggle with idolatry in this area of our lives. And I think Craig's the one who chose the title, how from idol to blessing. And I hope you'll be able to stay all day, because my morning plenary session is really going to be the idol part primarily. And the afternoon final session is going to be the blessing part. And I'm excited about both. We need both. But I'm especially excited in this afternoon just to see how the gospel transforms our attitude towards one another in marriage, especially in this area, which people have so fouled up. We are in a culture which is sex-obsessed, and sex becomes the ultimate thing for so many people. In the movie Titanic, Rose speaking now, I guess, as an older woman describing her lover from so many years ago, makes the statement, "He saved me in every way that a person could be saved." Speaking of a fornication experience. And that is the way the culture is about sex. It's everywhere, as all of us know. I don't need to give lots and lots of examples. But the church as well has become that way. I think one reason is the church has been so affected by the culture, and the kind of counseling problems we see are reflective of the culture. And one of the challenges is that the sexual idolatries of our culture have been adopted by so many professing Christians, and then when their idols aren't satisfying them and they're not getting what they think they deserve or demand, then they're either giving up on marriage or resorting to sin or becoming angry, and all these other problems spill over. Another challenge in the church is some have tried to answer this, and there's been some very blunt talk about sexual things by some believers, some Christian leaders. Just to set your mind at ease, our conference today is kind of rated G to PG. I mean, it's about, I think the Bible sometimes becomes PG. It's not going to become R. We can talk about these things and the way the Bible describes them without becoming graphic and specific, but that's also been a challenge in some sectors of the church, and we're not going where some people have gone in those areas. Some of you may have in mind some of what I'm talking about. I've actually, whenever I do one of these, I do a great deal of reading. Not always people I agree with or admire, but a great deal of broad reading. And I can tell you right now that the book that's affected me the most, and there's just two copies out there, so don't leave before the break. You can get your own on Amazon or something if those are gone. But Tim Keller's book, The Meaning of Marriage, has just been a great blessing to me as I've been refreshing my thoughts on these subjects. Not just, of course, about sex, but about marriage in general. And so, and the problem will be that as our culture has also made marriage and sexuality kind of a consumer experience, where I'm expecting to have this kind of wonderful, amazing romance in my life, and then when they don't get it, the consumer goes and shops elsewhere, as opposed to understanding marriage as a covenant, which involves commitment and perseverance, which ultimately leads to much greater happiness if one sticks it out in the way that God has taught. And when grace comes in, anybody can have a wonderful short-term consumer experience, at least in terms of how one feels physically, but long-term it leads to misery. So, overall, we understand biblically that God has created sex to be a blessing. In the past, some people claiming to be Christian have had the wrong idea that sex somehow is dirty or bad. Well, God made us sexual beings. He made us male and female from the beginning. And Adam and Eve, I think even in their nakedness, it's the openness that they had together, their innocence before God and each other, before the fall without possibility of sexual sin. And of course, we know that marriage, and I think marriage comprehensively, is designed by God to reflect our relationship with Him. And marriage is something that's holy. And as God is the one who created sex, He says, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother, shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." I see biblically, and you can categorize this different way, but fundamentally three reasons why God has given us this relationship. And the most important is that the sexual relationship in marriage is an expression of, and even an enhancement of, the oneness of the marriage covenant. In our ceremonies, typically the ring is a symbol. The Bible never talks about a ring as being a symbol, but we use it. That's fine. I'm wearing mine. But biblically, the symbol of marriage is something more private, and that is what a husband and a wife do together in the marriage bed. And God has designed this as a very powerful means of uniting a man and a woman and expressing the covenant they've made before the Lord. Keller writes, "Sex is perhaps the most powerful God-created way to help you give your entire self to another human being. Sex is God's appointed way for two people to reciprocally say to one another, 'I belong completely, permanently, and exclusively to you.'" And then he says, "You must not use sex for anything less." That's why Paul in 1 Corinthians 6, when he's talking about immorality, he says, "Do you not know the one who joins himself to a prostitute is one body with her? For he says the two shall become one flesh." You know, that's just, he's saying that's totally inappropriate. Because when you're joined physically with somebody, you're becoming one person. And that's only meant for the marriage covenant. Now also, you know, the world reverses things, and the world typically makes sex the basis for marriage. And you want to have sex so you get married. And I mean, there's a measure of truth to that, in that a godly person who feels the desire to be one will get married in order to fulfill that desire. But even then, marriage is built on so much more than just physical attraction and desire to come together sexually. As Stuart Scott writes, "Sex should not be the basis for any marriage. It expresses the oneness and commitment of marriage." Paul Tripp writes, "Marriage is built on physical attraction alone always lead to disappointment." So the beauty of God's design is that as the oneness personally grows, you come into marriage and you've made this covenant together, and the wedding night hopefully is a first experience together, and that as you grow closer personally, then this part of your marriage becomes more meaningful in expressing that covenant union. The second reason is God has chosen marriage and sex within marriage is the means by which He fills the earth with people. "Be fruitful and multiply," God said to Adam and Eve. And this is also reflecting the wisdom of God. And we see now in our culture what happens when you ignore the wisdom of God. God's wisdom is that children have a mother and a father, and that they raise these children together. And when you choose to get married, ordinarily it's with the purpose of having kids. I like what one author said, where he says, "Sex without children is like farming just to get a suntan." That's part of what you're getting. If there's a young couple that wanted to be married and they're saying, "Oh, but we don't have kids," I would question their motive. Now, if God providentially keeps you from having kids, if there are health reasons or age reasons, that's understandable. But I think something that's reflecting that, you know, do we just want to kind of have this permanent dating relationship? We don't really have to want to sacrifice ourselves for anybody. Well, if you don't want to sacrifice yourselves for kids, you're probably not going to do very well with each other either. Marriage is involving giving of yourself, not just getting a bunch of stuff for yourself. And again, the wisdom of God, and you see what's happened in our culture now. In the statistics I see, that in 1960, the children born out of wedlock in the United States were approximately 5 to 6%. What do you think it is now? 40%. Somebody's read it. Yeah, 40%. And in some minority segments of the population, as high as 70%, which results in dropping out of school, crime, all the other problems that are pervasive in the culture. So marriage is, sex is the expression of this covenant you've made in marriage. Sex is to produce children, which again is, God has given you this great blessing of marriage. Children are a blessing from God, the psalmist says. but it's something that you and your spouse share in together and sacrifice together to honor God in that way. And then the third reason the world does happen to get, and that is God has designed sex to be pleasurable. And we'll talk a lot about that before the day is over, that it's not something dirty. It's not like, as some so-called Christians have said, well, you do it because you have to and you just can't stand it anymore, or you do it because you want to have kids. And then I actually knew a guy from a certain sect of Christianity. I think he was a real Christian, but he and his wife got married, and he was from another culture, and they had a child, and the wife basically said, we're done. And he says, I've been, you know, and at that point he'd been living for 14 years with his wife like they were just kind of brother and sister, and that part of life was over because they achieved their goal of having one child. That is not what the Scripture says, that marriage is honorable and the marriage bed should be undefiled. But, you know, the Proverbs are going to be covering in a little while, you know, that it's something to be delightful. The Song of Solomon is in the Bible for a reason. Now, I do believe the Song of Solomon portrays the love of Christ for his church and the church for Christ, but it's doing it by using a real marriage as an illustration and the real delights of marriage in that way. And so negatively, and this is the expression of the idolatry we're going to talk about, you know, there's debate in our culture, there's even debate in some circles of the church, is kind of, is homosexuality allowed? Is, you know, is this allowed? Is that allowed? You know, the answer biblically is really simple. You don't have to come up with a bunch of verses to prove every single sex act is wrong, although they're in there, and I've got them in your notes. It's really simple. Marriage, sex. Inside of marriage, between one man and one woman, in covenant together for life, sex is good. Anything outside of that circle is wrong. I mean, I could almost go on, and we could have an early break. It's that simple. And it is what it's for. But adultery, you shall not commit adultery. Statistically, as many as half of men and a third of women in the course of a marriage have some kind of an affair. And this is something that maybe the world and Hollywood may glamorize. You know, there was a movie years ago that I did not see, but called The Bridges of Madison County, kind of the bored housewife, and I don't know if it was Robert Redford or somebody comes through town, and they have a fling while the husband's away, and that's supposed to kind of make her life meaningful. It's a big lie. And I wish you could come in and watch. Sometimes you wish you could videotape counseling sessions and blur the faces. And you sit with a couple when the wife or the husband has been adulterous. And you see the misery, and Proverbs describes that misery. And you see, and again, even sometimes, even so finally, okay, they gave up their spouse, and then now they're with this new guy. And I've counseled when she's with the new guy and said, you know, what happened? We were so excited together when we were having our affair, and now we're married and we hate each other, and we've only been married a few months. And the fact is, you can have a lot of excitement and a lot of thrills with somebody while you're having an affair. But it's different when it comes to, okay, we're going to build a life together for the next 50 years and learn each other's faults. That, you know, you can be thrilled with the idea that of the forbidden, the ego rush of somebody desiring you. But you probably aren't going to want to be with that person and what they're going to become over the next 20 or 30 years. Of course, the fact of the matter is, what they did to your spouse and or their spouse, they may do to you before too long. So this is something God hates, and of course he hates it for theological reasons, because if marriage is a picture of the covenant between God and his people and Christ and the church, and you, as the husband or the wife, you know, break the covenant and do this, that is horribly misrepresenting him. Something else we need to be very careful about is not just physical adultery, but affairs of the heart. When it says a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two become one flesh, the joined to the wife, and husband and wife being joined together, meaning there's a friendship and an intimacy personally between a husband and a wife that you can have with no one else in all the world, especially someone of the opposite sex. And it's an intrusion into the oneness and the intimacy of marriage to have a friend, or even they'll talk about, well, I'm married to this person, but I have my soulmate at work. And one author, I think, actually had a good phrase. He called it a work spouse, you know, where there's somebody at work and you hang out together with them, and maybe because you're Christian, you know you're not going to, at least you think you're not going to have sex with that person, But there's a bond that's developing between you and that person. And there also can be Facebook spouses or texting and whatever spouses, and how careful we need to be to guard our marriages, not just from the physical act of adultery, but from adulterous hearts that affect the relationship. Fornication, when it says, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Fornication is taking the privileges of marriage and the covenant of marriage without taking on the responsibilities. It's sex before marriage. And that's, again, something that our culture, something that was, I mean, it's not like this is a new thing that started happening just the last couple of years. It's always been done. But it used to be something that was wrong, that people knew it was wrong, and they did it anyway because they couldn't, they gave themselves over to sin. Whereas now, it's something that's just normal. Again, statistically, about 60% of those who are being married in our day will have been living together before they get married, which also, by the way, statistically greatly increases the likelihood of divorce. And then more and more people, somebody says, oh, well, isn't it good the divorce rate is going down? Well, the divorce rate in one sense is going down because people aren't even getting married. They're just living together and going from, you know, these kind of not legal marriages and legal divorces, but cohabitation followed by separation. And you know, the culture has lost its sense of shame in this way. Keller, in his book, quotes a passage from Jane Eyre, and he points out that in all these movies they make of the story Jane Eyre, he's never seen this speech in the movie, but when Rochester asks Jane to be his mistress, and he quotes from the book, basically where her heart and her mind battle with each other, but she knows she can't do what's wrong. And she says, even though desire says yes, she refuses to give in because there's a higher law to which she is subject. And the movies might be enhanced by that little internal speech of hers. When you are involved in fornication, you are stealing from your future spouse, if this is the person you're not married, but you're also stealing from your marriage, even if you wind up marrying this person. There's so many couples we've counseled where, actually, amazingly a large percentage, where they've done things before they were married that they know were wrong, and they carry that baggage into the marriage, and there is guilt, and that guilt often diminishes their ability to enjoy the blessings that God has given them once they are married. And those who are yet single need to be so careful. You may say, we're going to be married anyway. Yeah, but you're not. Until the covenant has been made before God and men, this person does not belong to you. You do not have rights over their body. And what you do can hurt your marriage later. And it's often the wife is the one who especially has a tender conscience. And the husband says, well, why is it before you're married you were so passionate and now you seem kind of frigid? Well, often there have been issues we've had to deal with in counseling of confessing to each other. And sometimes it doesn't even occur to them that the things they did before they were married were still sin. It's like, well, now we got married, it must have all been okay. No, it wasn't okay. And you've shared in the sin together. And sometimes it's been a great help to confess before God and one another where they did sin before and to be able to restore the marriage and hopefully restore what should be a delight in the marriage. And also, another aspect of our culture, people now think, well, as long as you haven't done one thing, you haven't had sex. Well, once you're married, you may understand this better, but the things that you're doing before you have sex are called foreplay. And there are things that you do to get ready to have sex. And it's part of sex. It's just not the whole thing. And it's all sex. And if you're doing something that's getting your body ready to have sex, you're starting to have sex. And if you think you can ski 95% of the way down the ski slope and then stop, it's probably not going to work sooner or later. You're probably going to fall off. But the point is you have no rights over this person's body until you're married. And an expression I heard last week I thought was very helpful is that what you want to do if you're single is to make good deposits in your marriage bank by making good choices now so that when you find the person you're going to marry, you're not going to have to spend a long time confessing your past to that person to see if they still want you. Or even together, that you're not going to do things before you're married that once you are married, you'll look back on for the rest of your life with regret. Or how you treat each other, where you both help each other to behave during your engagement so that your wedding night and your honeymoon And the marriage that follows can be as good as possible rather than going into debt in your marriage bank before you're even married. I'm not going to spend a long time on homosexuality. Tom has spent literally hundreds of hours preparing his breakout session, which is going to come after this one. And he's working on his thesis on this topic as well. But I can tell you that we have counseled many people who have struggled with homosexuality. And one aspect is that it's turning further from God's design, but it's just a sexual sin like all others, and it's sexual idolatry. And I think sometimes it's you've squeezed all the pleasure you can out of everything else, and so you turn to this. Or there's a flicker of interest in something forbidden, something you see on the internet or something you see out in public. And rather than starving it, rather than putting it to death, you feed it, you nurture it, and you've kind of got this little dragon monster, and you keep feeding it, and it gets stronger, and it takes over your life. And so there's a battle that has to go on, and if you're interested in that, I would very much encourage you to go to Tom's session. It is a huge issue in our day, and there are many professing Christians who are struggling, and of course the culture is glorifying it. But on the other hand, if somebody's struggling with it, it's not that much different than you're dealing with a fornicator or an adulterer. It's, here's God's circle, and anything outside is sin that needs to be dealt with as by the means that God has given through His Word, through the Gospel. Lust is another one we're going to have a breakout session on that I'm going to deal with, called the pain of porn. So I'm not going to deal extensively right now, but a huge, even in churches, the statistics you see is a majority of Christian men struggle to some degree with this. It is hard to live in Corinth. It's hard to live where it's so widely available. It's thrown in your face. I'm getting my hair cut this week, see? And the guy's just watching something. It's not even a, you know, one of the pay channel, but the crud that is on the television when I'm in there. And of course, I'm thinking about how I have to do this week. Just the things being thrown at me is just incredible. And as the culture becomes more and more corrupt, now they say that 30% of web porn visitors are women. And again, it is a huge issue. There are ways by God's grace one can be set free. Pornography destroys the intimacy that sex is supposed to bring in marriage. Sex is to be about relationship, commitment, and tenderness. Pornography is about using someone as an object to gratify yourself. It is often violent and selfish and cruel. It leads to people being unsatisfied with what God has given them. It's feeding the sexual idolatry, which is also why private sexual expression is also inappropriate. And that's just saying, oh, this is normal. To some degree, it is normal for people to struggle with that. But, like my example, is it normal for six-year-olds to struggle with the temptation to lie? Do we say to our kids, well, you know, that's just kind of normal, go ahead? Or do we help them to learn to fight the temptation? God made your body, your sexuality, for what? For a spouse someday. Don't spend your teenage years or your 20s misusing it to please yourself when it's supposed to be pleasing somebody else. Now, does that mean it's going to be easy? Does that mean we're expecting every young man and young woman to live perfectly in this area? No, any more than you don't expect seven-year-olds to lie. But you try to teach them, especially as believers, to battle that sin and to overcome the struggles that are normal is God gives grace. And of course, the problem is lust conceived, James says, gives birth to sin, and sin results in death. And after, you know, lust isn't satisfied at stopping at one point. The person who's looking or thinking is going to be tempted to keep moving down the line, and it will become more and more destructive. This is also an area where getting accountability can be very helpful. And the Bible mentions other sexual sins. I'm not going to go into every single one of them. There are verses in Leviticus that talk about things you may have never thought of before. But what we do know is that sexual sin brings misery. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. The one who sows to his own flesh shall from his flesh reap corruption. There's a price to be paid. So God has made sex a good thing. But we have made a mess of it in our sin. And this is where I want to get to the heart of the first talk. And the problem with us as human beings sexually is not so much sex, but it is idolatry. Not adultery, but idolatry. And in the Bible, many places you'll see sex as being a God problem, a theological problem. Paul writes to the Thessalonians, this is the will of God, your sanctification, that is, that you abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you may know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who do not know God. So why do the Gentiles live as they do? Why do the unbelievers give themselves over to every kind of sexual sin that you see portrayed all around you, even if you're trying to avoid looking at it? It's because they don't know God. And of course, if you do know God, you will be set free from these things. And also just recognizing, and this is very, very important, it's also important when people are struggling in marriage, sexual sin needs to be seen primarily not as a sin against a spouse, but against God. Psalm 51, after David committed adultery, what does he say to God? Against you, God, and you only have I sinned. That sexual sin is always an issue with God. The spouse is affected. That's secondary. And this is also helpful. If your spouse is struggling with sexual sin, you need to realize that they have a God problem much more than a you problem. And this is also how you can help your spouse. Because if you see their sexual sin is only being about you, you're going to be tempted to be angry. You're going to be tempted to be vengeful. You're going to be tempted to take it entirely personally. And it's going to just make you add to the problems in the relationship. When you see that when your spouse is struggling, that or your child is struggling, that is it is a reflection of the struggle they're having in their relationship with God, then you can come alongside and how can I help restore you to God rather than how can I blow off my steam because of how mad I am of what you've done to me. And so, as I said, it's idolatry more than adultery that is the key to understanding sexual sin. And in Romans 1, as Paul is describing how the wrath of God is revealed against all mankind, and he's described how even though we knew God, we did not choose to honor him or give thanks to him. And he describes that in God's judgment of humanity for rejecting the innate knowledge they have of God and the knowledge of God they have in creation, he says, therefore God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them, for they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. And the person who is enslaved to sexual sin is a worshiper. And he has chosen to abandon the worship of God in order to worship his own pleasure. And that can be homosexual pleasure, that can be heterosexual pleasure, that can be self-pleasure, that can be pornography, whatever form it takes. But he's made his highest good that rather than God. What is an idol? An idol is not just a hunk of wood or stone that we bow down before. An idol, and elsewhere in Scripture, in Ezekiel, he talks about the idols of the heart. An idol is anything we put in God's place. It's what we value the most. It's what do you turn to for refuge and comfort? Well, you know the right answer, don't you? When you're feeling lonely and empty and discouraged, where do you go to find relief? What is the supreme good in your life? What is it you look forward to? What is you think about all day long is what's going to make you happy? Well, for many in our culture, and even many professing Christians, that is something sexual. And the problem with idolatry is that even something that in and of itself is good can become sinfully idolatrous when we desire it more than we desire God. You understand that? That, I mean, even in marriage, I mean, even apart from sex, your spouse, if you love your spouse more than God, he or she becomes an idol. And it's going to foul up your relationship with God and with your spouse. Now, there are other good things. Food is good, but if you make food an idol, you become a slave, and it ruins your life. And we've already said sex biblically is a good thing, but sex probably as much or more than anything our culture deals with, materialism alongside of it, when it is made an idol, when it becomes your supreme good, that becomes an idol because it is more important to you than God. And something else you can tell that it's an idol is that when you're ready to sin, when you don't get it, you know, if I don't get what I want here, then I'm going to be angry, mean, or go do something evil. Then it's an idol. Or when you react sinfully when you don't get it. My needs weren't met, therefore. And so lust is the idolatry of sex. Keller writes, in our culture, sex is a way to be yourself and to find yourself. It's for individual fulfillment, for self-realization, however you wish to pursue it. And of course, that kind of idolatrous lust in the heart is going to lead to all these sexual sins. But again, that's why, whether it's in your own life or if it's in the life of someone you're counseling or trying to help or even your own spouse, the way to overcome sexual sin isn't just to say, stop that, that's disgusting, don't do that anymore. You have to identify there is a heart issue here. This person in their heart, as much as you believe in Christ to save you, they believe sex will save them. They believe sex will make them happy. They believe sex will fulfill them. And they need to repent of that idolatrous heart before and then turning to God to find what He alone can give them. So it is lust which is not satisfied within God's limits that goes outside, because what matters is I want to feel a certain way, I want to have certain experiences in life, and nobody can stop me because that's the supreme good of my life. 2 Peter 2, for speaking out arrogant words of vanity, they entice by fleshly desires, by sensuality, those who barely escape from the ones who live in error, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by what a man is overcome, by that he is enslaved. And that's describing the culture in which we live. And I will add, it's hard as a believer to resist when all the culture is moving in one direction. You're swimming upstream. So, and something else, that sexual idolatry can even occur within marriage, or I would say also for a single person who's not yet married. For a single person, you can have sexual idolatry just saying, I must be married in order to be happy. God must provide for me a spouse, and not just a spouse, but one who is romantic and affectionate, or my life isn't worth living. That is idolatry. Is it wrong to want a spouse? No. But if you must have that, and you want that more than you want God Himself, one thing is, you're not ready to be married, and I pity the person you would marry if that's where your heart is. But the idea that, you know, and then for married people, the idolatry of saying, I must have a thrilling sexual relationship with my spouse. Now, is it sin to want that? No. This afternoon, I want to talk about how biblically that's possible through grace. But if you're not going to get it, and there's no promise that you will, can you find satisfaction in God? If not, it becomes an idol. Or I must have sex a certain number of times a week within marriage. I must be able to have sex when I want to have sex. My spouse must stay in good shape, must look a certain way for me. I must feel attractive. I must feel loved. My spouse needs to be as interested in sex as I am. And, you know, frustrated if they don't seem to care about it as much as you do. My spouse must do certain things for me sexually for me to be happy, and they must like it. I must have a spouse who is romantic and communicates with me before I'm expected to have sex with him or her. I must be able to sleep when I want to sleep. Every sexual experience must be perfect and amazing. My spouse must acknowledge me as an amazing lover. I must have intense romantic passion in my life if my life is to be full. Now, there's nothing sinful in terms of wanting those things. And yet, if those things become the most important desire of your life, and you're willing to sin if you don't get it, they've become idols, and it's going to ruin your marriage, it's going to make you miserable, and it's going to take you away from the Lord. So, well, how can I know if I'm a sexual idolater or my spouse is a sexual idolater? And it's, Are you obsessed with what you think you must have? That list I just read, a lot of it's in your notes, where your life revolves around those desires. And it could be food. You know, there's a lot of things it could be. It could be the new iPad that's going to be announced next week. I got to have one. That's all you're thinking about. Some next year seminar. Hopefully I'll have my iPad by then. And then here's where it really boils down to. Do you get angry when you don't get what you think you must have? Now, for a single person, God hasn't given me a spouse yet. I'm trying. And then with the anger comes the temptation. Well, if God isn't going to give me a spouse, I'll find a non-Christian. Or I'll go commit this evil, or I'll go look at this or do that by myself. And this is the irony, too, is that on the one hand, the person is saying to the spouse, I need you so much. I love you so much. I desperately need you. I love you. I want to make love to you. It's so important to me. But then when they're not all gung-ho, the idolater then is mad. The person that he said he couldn't live without, he loved with all his heart, now he's furious with this person. And the one he said he loved, he hated. Who did he really love? Himself. And then he's offended. Okay, the silent treatment. And sexual idolatry leads to many significant problems in the marriage relationship. James says, what is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and you do not have, so you commit murder. You're envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. And here, the pleasures that wage war in your members, it's not always something wrong. Is it wrong for a wife to want her husband to be romantic? It's not wrong. Is it wrong for a husband to want his wife to be responsive? It's not wrong. Is it wrong for a single person to yearn for someone to complete them, as Genesis 2:18 describes? It's not wrong to have those desires. But when they become controlling, idolatrous desires, then there's going to be, when this person doesn't meet my needs, you're going to get, again, there's going to be anger. There's going to be frustration building up inside. My spouse obviously doesn't want to meet my needs. Therefore, here's somebody at work who will talk to me, who will listen to me, who's available. Or my spouse is too much trouble and I can go to the internet and find Miss October, two-dimensional prostitute. She's willing to, in my fantasy, do anything. That's easier than a wife or a husband now. I need to find my soulmate. I need to find the person who will, somehow meet what my spouse isn't meeting. And the answer, and see, this is the problem too, is when you're dealing with your own heart or dealing with others, the tendency to think, my problem would be solved if my spouse would change. My problem would be solved if I had a spouse or if I had a better spouse or whatever the terminology would be. No. As long as this is your supreme good, as long as this is your idol, you will never be satisfied. And you see people go from marriage to marriage and relationship to relationship, and no one ever meets that need, so-called, that there's only one place you're going to find ultimate satisfaction, and that is in the Lord. We've used this passage before. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. You have no money. Come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why do you spend money for what is not bread and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good and delight yourself in abundance. The sexual idolater needs to learn that, by the way, there's nothing wrong if God gives you a spouse to enjoy being married. There's nothing wrong if you have a warm marriage relationship to enjoy all the things that you're tempted to turn into idols as long as they're in their place. But also to realize that because you're marrying a sinful human being, if you're married, who is not going to be able to meet all of your needs, you have to look to God to meet your ultimate needs. And actually, I remember for myself when Carol and I were courting in college, when it occurred to me in my heart of hearts that I really thought I'd grown up enough that I loved God more than I loved her. And I really thought that if I had a choice between Christ coming tomorrow and getting married tomorrow, I'd pick the former, even though we were behaving somewhat. I thought, yeah, maybe I have become a man. Maybe I've grown up a little bit to be able to think that way. And I'm not saying I'm free of all the idolatries I'm describing, but that it your spouse is going to let you down, but Christ will always satisfy you. He is the bread of life. He is the living water. And then when you're finding your ultimate satisfaction in Him, you can enjoy the other gifts. And it's not just sex and marriage or marriage. The same thing can be said of food and drink and rest and material things. None of those things are inherently wrong. They can be good gifts from Him, but they're under Him. C.S. Lewis writes, ever-increasing craving, lust is ever-increasing craving for ever-diminishing pleasure. It never satisfies, but God does satisfy. Whatever we do is to be done for the glory of God. Immorality is obviously a sin against God, but he says at the end, your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own, for you've been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. That this part of life is under God. This part of life is for His glory. In faith, we trust God to give us what is right in this part of life. To be content. To trust God that His way is best. John Piper writes that the pleasures and goodness of sex are heightened by proper restraint. The world says, let off all your restraints. But it's the very restraint, and some of the restraint is even when you're married, to look to God more than your spouse for satisfaction. That is going to make sex better than looking to sex as the ultimate pleasure. But he also, another thing Piper writes is, knowing the supremacy of Christ enlarges the soul so that sex and its little thrills become as small as they really are. Isn't that a good quote? That knowing the supremacy of Christ, you know, when you see how glorious Christ is, how worthy He is of your affection, how He never lets you down, it puts sex in its place. There's no denying that sex can be thrilling, but it's small compared to the thrill of knowing Christ. And then if you don't get what you're hoping for, you'll survive. So, moving on, one more topic before our break. And the break is not imminent, by the way. Just illustrating these points is what the Proverbs teach about wisdom, and it's going to be kind of an overview. A large part of Proverbs deals with sexual wisdom. And a lot of, you know, it's written to a young person, and I'm not just speaking to young men, I think it's young men, young women. I'm going to go back and forth in terms of what he's getting at. But in the overview of Proverbs, what I've seen is in Proverbs, he describes one lady who can destroy you, and that's Madame Folly. And she's portrayed sometimes figuratively, sometimes as a literal loose woman who's offering herself to the naive young man. And there are two ladies who can help you. One is your wife. She may help you, but not everybody has a wife or a husband. And not everybody who has a husband or a wife has a real helpful one, which means your spouse may help you, but wisdom will always help you. So I want to go through that for a few minutes. I think most of the verses will be flashed up on the screen. In Proverbs 7, you have really a description of a seduction. And as I read this, again, contrasting to how some Christians are writing about sex now, you see in Proverbs, you see in the Song of Solomon, you get the idea of what's going on, but it never goes past G or a little bit of PG. He doesn't have to fill in all the details. And it also, the Bible is so wise in that it doesn't do it in a way that's kind of titillating, like it portrays it favorably, like the world portrays adultery. It portrays it with all of the consequences and none of the sordid details. But it gets the idea across. And I have to, you know, as I read this, and I've counseled people who have fallen into adultery, it's like, yeah, that's 3,000 years ago. It's still the same. I could tell people's story, and it's just like this. And it's told, he's told you, watch out. He's already said in chapters 5 and 6, watch out for sexual sin. But now he actually tells the story, and it reminds me of like one of these things you used to watch like on, National Geographic Channel or Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom when I was a kid, where you've got the little zebra kind of walking out in the Serengeti, and he's gotten away from the herd, and then the camera flashes over to the lioness, and she's stalking him. And that's what's happening here. And you see the little zebra Verse 6, for at the window of my house I looked out through my lattice and I saw among the naive, I discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense passing through the street near her corner. And he takes the way to her house in the twilight and in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness. And this guy is not a hardened sinner. He is naive. And so many professing Christians have fallen into sexual sin. It's not like they planned to do this. They just put themselves in situations where they were vulnerable. They were naive. They were unwise. They weren't fools and scoffers. But this guy, he walked near her house. He walks near where the temptation is. A dangerous time in a dangerous place. A little flirtation. Everybody does it. A little brush of the hand in the office. And then it happens again a little later. And thoughts begin. And it seems so innocent. It seems so common. And then you have the huntress and her tactics. And behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. She is boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the squares, and lurks by every corner. So she seizes him, kisses him. And with a brazen face, she says to him, I was due to offer peace offerings. Today I have paid my vows. Therefore I have come out to meet you. To seek your presence earnestly. And I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings, with colored linens of Egypt. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. And it's interesting, later we're going to see in the book of Song of Solomon how in marriage every human sense is used for good in the sexual relationship in marriage. But she comes as a counterfeit wife, and she offers all the same things. She attacks this guy. I don't know if you've read Holy War by Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress. And he talks about how man's soul, the city, was attacked, and you've got all these different gates. And she attacks through the eye gate. She's alluring in her appearance. Her clothes revealing her alluring body. The ear gate, and probably the way to a man's heart is not his stomach or even his eyes, but his ears through flattering him. You know, she touches his ego that you're so strong, you're so smart. And this is what happens often in an affair, is that I can't believe someone that attractive would be interested in me. They think I'm so amazing, my spouse doesn't seem impressed with me at all, and this person just thinks I'm wonderful. I worship your mind, she says. The flatterer is spreading a net for your feet. And Jesus says, I was looking just for you. And then she touches him. Her lips are warm. Her skin is soft. She even offers him food. You know, I've done my peace offering. And the peace offering, you basically the steaks are on the grill. You know, that we've got the best meat. And you've got this mixture of religion going in. And then she's got perfume in her bedroom. And it's all just so amazing, and it's, you know, it's the ultimate in sexual exhilaration. It's prom night. My parents got us a hotel room, whatever ridiculousness there may be, and all of your idolatrous desires are going to be met. Everything you've dreamed of and more is going to happen to you. Now, nicely, it doesn't tell us any more than that. It doesn't have to. We know what's going on. We don't need to think about it too much. She overcomes, you know, again, his doubts and his fears. My husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him. At full moon, he'll come home. Nobody will catch us. We're adults. We're consenting adults. Someday we'll get married. Your spouse doesn't love you anyway. Your marriage is over. It doesn't matter. Or, you know, we will be married someday. We'll practice safe sex. But then, with her many persuasions, she entices him. With her flattering lips, she seduces him. And this is where the lioness jumps on top of the poor zebra. Suddenly he follows her. As an ox goes to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the discipline of a fool, until an arrow pierces through his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his life. Mr. Zebra is now rolling on the ground. I won't tell more details than that. But he's in a bad way. The victim's defenses are overwhelmed. By the time he gets to that point, he's helpless. And she has many victims, we read at the end of the chapter. People like David, people like Samson, people like many famous preachers, people that I could almost fill this room with, counselees, couples, singles, who have fallen into sexual sin. And this person is everywhere. This man seducing the woman seducing the man. You know, sometimes when somebody has an affair, or even like an adult child commits fornication, the spouse or the parents are mad at the person that did it with them. Like, oh, that woman did that to my boy, or, you know, that man took away my wife. No. Again, who do they sin? It's against God they're sinning. There are going to be adulterers and adulteresses available at all times for those who are foolish enough to go to them. It's not the woman's fault this happened. It's the man who gave in. There's always going to be somebody willing to have sinful sex with another willing party. So you're warned here about Madam Folly will ruin your life. More bitter than death, the woman whose heart snares and nets, whose hands are chains, one who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. And again, or him. On the other hand, Proverbs teaches your spouse may help to protect you from sexual immorality. In Proverbs 5, drink water from your own cistern, fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad and your streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breasts satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? So, biblically, the answer to sexual desire is not always abstinence. For most, and even Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, it's better to marry than to burn. But marriage is not some like embarrassing outlet. It's meant by God to be something delightful. It's honorable. 1 Timothy, Paul talks about those who wrongly forbid marriage and other good gifts of God as if that was somehow more holy. That is absolutely unbiblical. But God's ideal is that within marriage, that one direct all one's sexual desire towards one spouse, finding happiness together, as 1 Corinthians 7, we'll talk about more later, that your body belongs to your spouse to please them, and you help each other to have self-control. The language of the Song of Solomon describing this great happiness you can have within marriage, but also to be content. And, you know, in Proverbs 5, it says, let her breasts satisfy you at all times. And I've had multiple cases where a guy would say, you know, I'm trying to talk my wife into getting some surgery to kind of get enhanced up there. Well, if you weren't looking at all these other women, you'd be really happy with the one you had. If those were the only ones you're looking at, they'd be great. Let her breast satisfy you. And he's comparing to something he shouldn't be looking at rather than being really happy with what he has. And so to be content, and that your spouse is meant by God to be your standard of beauty. And looking, thinking, and fantasizing about others is diminishing that. And you delight in that person. You share something together privately. A garden locked is my sister. It's something just the two of you share. Nobody else knows much about. Which is one reason, again, I'm not going to write a detailed book like some have done describing all of my personal bad things and good things. It's not, you don't need to do that. But it should be exhilarating. And then this word exhilarating is actually kind of amazing because so much of the Christian life is about sex, self-control. And you know, before you're married, self-control in this area. But here's one place where God says, when you're married and you're with your spouse, let yourself go. I mean, we're not supposed to be intoxicated, generally speaking. It's a bad thing. But this is one place in life. Be intoxicated with her love, he's saying. And some people, again, some people, all the different ideas about sex that people have, some wrong ideas some people have about sex is like, no, they can be too restrained within marriage. And some of it may be you've been fighting all your single life to be restrained, and now you're married, and all of a sudden it's a real adjustment to shift gears from reverse to forward. But the Scripture is saying, yes, do that. The Puritans have this bad reputation as if they were against sex. They were all for sex within marriage. One of the Puritans writes, couples may joyfully give due benevolence one to the other as two musical instruments in a well-tuned consort. That's G-rated, isn't it? That's all you need to know. And as you go through the Song of Solomon, remember all the stuff about the harlot in chapter 7? And see, there's no denying. Proverbs is so realistic. Having an affair, committing fornication, committing adultery in the short term is very exciting physically. And it does entice all the senses. The problem is it's short-lived, and then you're miserable. And the difference is in marriage, you get all the same stuff, but it's without guilt, and it keeps going and getting better. So why be an idiot? It's kind of the negative in Proverbs is that within marriage and all the same senses, sight and sound and smell and touch and taste, or in the Song of Solomon, you've made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride. You've made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. And I'm not going to read the part, but I mean, they describe each other from head to toe, right? In Song of Solomon, every part you can imagine. And then sound, oh my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the secret place of the steep pathway, let me see your form. Let me hear your voice. Your voice is sweet. Your form is lovely. Your oils are a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. May he kiss thee with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. In his shade I took great delight and sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. That sounds really nice, doesn't it? That's what God has designed. That's in the Bible. To give yourself over in that context. And of course, the blessing of marriage, and Keller does a good job of describing this, that when people are having an affair, it's about performance and impressing the other person and trying to give them enough to keep them in the relationship, and it's the consumer thing. When you're married, there's a covenant you've made. You're in for life. And that commitment makes it so much sweeter and safer to really be yourself and to give yourself away in marriage. And so, one thing that is important for this, that if this is only in the context of a godly marriage, which I'm going to talk a lot in the last session, how do you have a marriage where this can take place? It's not automatic. Some of us know that already, don't we? I counsel couples who have been married sometimes just a few years who hardly touch each other anymore because there's such a relationship problems they can't have sex joyfully together. So if you're not godly and if your marriage isn't reflecting godliness, this isn't going to happen. And if you're single and you're not godly, a wife isn't going to solve your problems, or a husband is going to solve your problems. Some people think, if I just got married, it would all be good. It would all be easy. All these problems would be over. Well, if you're a sexual idolater and you're looking to marry someone to fulfill those idolatrous desires and to serve you in that way, things may get worse if you get married. So if you're married, you need to take care of your garden. And that's not just the sexual part. It's the whole relationship. We'll talk more about that later. Bringing grace and really a Christ-like love into the marriage. And then if you are single, how you want to protect all the blessings, all the sights and the smells and the touches that are so wonderful in marriage, to not give that away or receive it from anyone until the time you can give it inside your marriage garden with the one whom God gives you. So we've seen that Madam Folly will destroy you. A wife or a husband may help you, but Lady Wisdom will protect you. You see the difference? The point is, we've got single people here, and they said, you're describing that, and that kind of makes me want to get married, but there's nobody in the immediate prospect, or I'm not old enough yet. And then you got married people sometimes and say, that sounds really good too, but it's better to live on a corner of a roof than with my spouse. This only works if you have a helpful spouse. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who shames him is his rottenness in his bones. And there are, again, some have no spouse, but some just have a spouse who isn't very helpful. I've been surprised to find actually more cases lately where there are husbands who won't have sex with their wives than wives who won't have sex with their husbands. But either way, if you're looking to your spouse to meet that ultimate need, I can't promise you it's going to work. Actually, the ultimate need won't be met anyway. But this is the good news, that if you find yourself even in no marriage or in a hard marriage or in a time in your marriage where, you know, maybe someone's deployed in military or, you know, different circumstances taking place, a spouse will not always solve this problem for you. Your spouse can't meet these ultimate needs. Jeremiah 17, which says, "Cursed is the man who trusts in mankind, who makes the flesh his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord, who will be like a bush in the desert." That if you're looking to your spouse alone to meet these needs, you're going to be like the bush in the desert, because your spouse will let you down. Your spouse will sin. Your spouse can't be God to you. Which is why you need what, in Proverbs, wisdom, in my understanding, is ultimately pointing to Christ, in whom are hidden the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, Paul says in Colossians. He is to us wisdom from God, Paul says in Corinthians. So wisdom should be your first love, and then your wife or your husband, your second love. Wisdom reflecting God. Acquire wisdom, acquire understanding. Do not forget, nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, and she will guard you. Love her. She will watch over you. The beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom. And with all you're acquiring, get understanding. Prize her, and she will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place on your head a garland of grace. She will present you with a crown of beauty. Now, some of you are familiar with Proverbs, or even one of the verses previously, it talks about how a good wife is like a crown to her husband. Well, here it's saying wisdom will crown you. With all that a good wife should be to you, wisdom will be to you. Unconditionally, as you turn to God and seek wisdom in that way. Say to wisdom, "You are my sister." Call understanding your intimate friend. And so, as you learn, you know, like, and Paul warns in Timothy, talks about some who are lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. We need to be lovers of God more than we're lovers of pleasure, even legitimate pleasure. And as we love God and love Him and the wisdom He gives and delight ourselves in Him and are satisfied in Him, then we will be kept safe from sexual sin. People turn to sexual sin, again, because of their relationship with God more than their relationship with their spouse. Well, how does wisdom help you? Proverbs gives a few different ways. One is, Lady Wisdom helps you to see the nature of Madam Folly or Mr. Folly. By the way, women are stupid too, okay? Not just men. I mean, sometimes you see this, like in the old movies, where, you know, you see the beautiful, innocent girl, and then you see kind of the bad dude, and she falls for him. You know, what is she thinking? That the nice boy next door is nothing because James Dean or somebody walks on the screen, and, you know, and he's all angsty and selfish and angry all the time. And, you know, I'm just amazed how women fall for bad guys. And that women are seduced. Women are drawn astray by men who are just like the evil woman described earlier. And what he's saying, and there's a picture, I've told this to guys, but it's true of women as well. Wouldn't you love to wear glasses? And the glasses would help you to see a bad man or a bad woman as they really are, rather than just seeing what they are on the outside. And so when a man sees a woman very modestly dressed and very flirtatious, instead of seeing the curves in the body and the temptation described in Proverbs 7, instead he sees like something, this hideous monster that he just wants to run away from. You know, and likewise for a man, when some guy's being kind of overly friendly, and again, this happens where a married woman, and she's in the workplace, and some guy's being real nice to her and paying a lot of attention to her, and her husband paid that much attention to her, he understands that well, and she's tempted to be kind of flattered by that and like that. Instead, again, she just sees this hideous monster with fangs and blood dripping from his lips about to, you know, destroy her family, and her marriage. And what Proverbs is saying, that's what wisdom will do for you. Wisdom gives you those glasses. And in chapter 2, he says, wisdom will deliver you from a strange woman or man, from the adulteress who flatters with her words, that leaves the companion of her youth, that forgets the covenant of her God, for her house sinks down to death. Her tracks lead to the dead, and none who go to her return again, nor do they reach the paths of life. So wisdom helps you to see the nature of the adulterer, or the temptation, even the two-dimensional temptation. And, you know, this thing gets flashed up, you're checking the sports scores, and all of a sudden a bikini person pops up on your sports page and your computer, and you're going, oh no, but you think, that girl has a mother and a father, and that body was made for a husband, wasn't made for me, and what is she doing? This isn't right. This is exploiting her, and it's having her look as a, just see it as God sees it. And you know, in this case too, this woman, like in Proverbs 7, is someone who's hardened and boisterous. She's, you know, it says that she leaves the companion of her youth. And then this is the thing I was saying earlier, that it's easy to be excited in a short-term relationship where you're thrilled that this person wants you and physically there are things happening that are exciting. But she left the last guy and the guy before and the guy before. She's not a covenant keeper. She left him. She forgets the covenant that God has made in marriage. And one day she'll be done with you or you'll be done with her. One day you're going to hate each other. Think ahead. See her character. She doesn't fear God. You know, the woman in Proverbs, oh, I've made my peace offering. She's religious. But she's a hypocrite. She's going to, you know, in the midst of her adultery, eat the meat from the sacrifice. Outward forms of religion. She's a counterfeit wife, offering counterfeit love. She calls it love. It shouldn't, Matthew Henry says, it's a pity that the name of love should be so abused. You know, we're going to drink our fill of love. Not at all. And then wisdom also just shows you why it's wrong. And that goes along with the consequences. I was reading, again, another of the books, and one of the guys was saying, you know, it's good to talk about the goodness of marriage and this and that. So, you know, there's one thing that I think you need to get across to people, and that is fear is not a bad thing. Just to be scared to death. One of the attachments I gave you, I think, is Randy Alcorn's list of anticipated consequences of sexual immorality. Facing his congregation, facing his spouse, facing his children, you know, all the things that come off of that. You know, folly lives for the moment. What will make me happy in the next half an hour? Wisdom is thinking about the next half century. And wisdom shows you that, you know, how it's wrong in relation to God. You've sinned against God. How did Joseph resist Potiphar's wife? He didn't say, well, I'm not really attractive to you. I mean, before he ran, he says, how can I do this and sin against God? It's kind of like the quote from Jane Eyre that, yeah, this is an attractive offer you're making, but I'm accountable to someone higher than you, and I can't give in to this. And when you go after that idol that way, you're acting like an atheist. In relation to your neighbor, and Proverbs brings this out as well, as you're taking someone's daughter, you're taking someone's granddaughter, you're taking someone's son, spouse, whatever it may be, you know, what could be a worse violation of love of neighbor than to flirt with another man's wife or to fornicate with another man's future wife? What if this person married your best friend someday, the person you're dating? How's that going to go? And then, of course, just in relation to yourself, you will groan at your latter end when your flesh and your body are consumed. And you will say, how I have hated instruction and my heart spurned reproof. And I have not listened to the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to my instructors. And Proverbs is very specific about the consequences of sexual sin. So is the one who goes in to his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. Wounds and disgrace he will find. His reproach will not be blotted out. For jealously enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be content that you give him any gifts. Tomorrow morning in our church, I'm preaching from Psalm 32, which David wrote about his sexual sin with Bathsheba. And he describes that after that, he says, night and day your hand was heavy upon me. My body wasted away as with the fever heat of summer. And of course, I don't think it's a coincidence that all these diseases take place when you sin sexually. It seems like God has designed immorality to be costly physically. Then he's talking about the people you've wronged. Do you know who Ahithophel is? Well, he's the guy that advised Absalom, who was so wise, when Absalom rebelled against David. Do you know Ahithophel, who his granddaughter was? Bathsheba. That's what he said. Other people are affected by what you've done, and they're going to hate you. It's going to destroy your reputation. You're going to find wounds and disgrace. Think about these well-known either political leaders, Christian leaders, the shame heaped upon them, the misery that comes, the damage to their own families, the broken trust of the spouse, the children affected. Look at David's sons and the evil in which so many of them fell. I think in chapter 5 when he talked about, you know, your waters through the streets, I think he's describing illegitimate kids. And then spiritually, God will judge you. Your sin will find you out. And ultimately, there's death. And so it's Lady Wisdom who trains you to stay far from sexual temptation. You know, the highest motive is your love for God and your delight for God. I don't want to take that away. Delight yourself in Him and this will not overtake you. But if that ain't working, run because you're terrified. Come to your senses and realize you're about to ruin your life. Don't go near her door. I mean, you guard your heart, but also just not even taking the first step, realizing, just like if someone's being a bit flirtatious with you, just like, I remember Lost in Space, they had that robot, you know, go, warning, warning, Will Robinson. It's just kind of like, you know, the red light should be going off and you're saying to yourself, and you know, that something like that's happening, or you're looking at a web page, it's going to lead to another web page, and warning, what are you doing? What are you, you know, you're going down a road that's going to ruin you. Some guys being too friendly. Don't put yourself in those situations. Work is a place of great danger. That's where so many affairs come from. There's an appropriate distance and reserve that men and women who aren't married to each other should show for each other in respecting their own marriage or their future marriage and the marriage of the other person. And I would rather have a reputation as being a little bit standoffish the reputation of being a flirt. And perhaps some here are already very near the edge of that cliff. Be careful. A man who never wants to fall off a cliff should not hang around the edge of the cliff. And just don't trust yourself. Be careful if you think you stand lest you fall. You know, somebody said, what did Joseph do? Finally he ran. Why did he run? Because walking wasn't safe. Paul says, flee youthful lusts. If you think you stand, be careful lest you fall. If it could happen to David, it could happen to you. Again, there's a false idea in the world that men and women can be close in these so-called platonic relationships without it becoming sexual. These relationships have electricity that you just wouldn't have with someone of the same gender, and they often lead to trouble. Be very, very careful. And then back to where we began as we conclude, that it's Lady Wisdom who's going to satisfy you, not Madam Folly. Madam Folly represents here all sexual idolatry. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out her 7 pillars. She has prepared her food. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her maidens. She calls from the tops of the height to the city. Whoever is naive, let him turn in here. To him who lacks understanding, she says, come, eat of my food and drink of the wine I have mixed. Forsake your folly and live and proceed in the way of understanding. It's actually interesting because later, Madam Folly also has a banquet, later in Proverbs 9. Where are you going to eat? And what's being saying is God's wisdom alone will satisfy your soul. And when you find your greatest satisfaction in Him, then you can find satisfaction in His gifts as He allows. Even if you're single, even if you're dealing with a difficult time in your marriage, wisdom will never fail you. God will never fail you. When He is first, then you can endure. And when He is first, then you can enjoy in the greatest possible way. So we're warned to flee from sexual immorality. We receive help, possibly from a spouse, certainly from God through His wisdom. We're going to have Craigson come and make some announcements after I pray, but this afternoon, please come back, because this has been kind of the negative, flee from idolatry. This afternoon is going to be the positive, how grace can transform your marriage and can help you to take God's gift and receive the blessings from it that God has designed. So let me pray before Craig comes. Father in heaven, we thank You for Your word, that it speaks powerfully, infallibly, practically, and appropriately to us. You know the needs of each one here. For those who are struggling, give them grace to turn to You. For those of us, as many of us struggle with idols in our own hearts, Lord, help us to really believe that satisfaction is to be found in Jesus, who is the bread of life, the living waters. And help us when we feel empty and thirsty or lonely. to turn to Him. Help in the remaining sessions, those who do the breakout sessions, to speak Your word lovingly, graciously, and appropriately. Give help to Your people, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.